Quickly, immobilize her!
You've made a very foolish mistake, Wonder Woman.
Wonder Woman debuted in All-Star Comics number 8 on October 25th, 1941. The George Perez written and drawn volume of Wonder Woman started on November 6, 1986, coming out a month after Wonder Woman's 45th anniversary. The event miniseries War of the Gods came out on July 6, 1991, which was intended to lead into George Perez's fifth year on the Wonder Woman title and the 50th anniversary of The Amazing Amazon. Unfortunately, DC Comics had given the series a vote of no confidence. I recall reading in one of the price guides at the time that had an interview with George Perez where he basically said that one of the first things DC wanted to do with the War of the Gods event was to diminish Wonder Woman's role in it. They came up with a competing event, the Armageddon 2001 story arc that ran through that year's annuals. War of the Gods itself was only going to run across four double-sized issues that would be available only through the direct market, so the newsstand would get tie-ins to the book without getting the main book, although that wasn't too much of a worry because there really weren't that many War of the Gods tie-ins, which was a big complaint of George Perez. And in DC Comics' defense, they had some complaints of their own. For starters, superstar artist George Perez was only inking the book while penciling a competing event miniseries, The Infinity Gauntlet, at Marvel Comics, whose sales were extraordinarily higher than War of the Gods. Ultimately, George Perez did not finish Infinity Gauntlet, and apparently there were also delays with War of the Gods. The final issue shipped over a month after his expected point of finale. The relationship between George Perez and DC seemed to deteriorate rapidly. For years, I had thought that George Perez up and quit the title, but in doing research for this podcast, it turns out that DC replaced him. I don't know if it was a situation where he said he was leaving and DC went ahead and pushed him, or if it was entirely DC's choice. It was apparently DC's choice to bring in a new writer, William Mester Loebs, based on how well he'd written the Wonder Woman character in one of those rare War of the Gods tie-ins, an issue of Dr. Fate. But you can tell just from looking at the publication schedule that this got thrown together quickly, and there were clearly some significant problems with getting the Wonder Woman book out around the time of War of the Gods. Perhaps the most unfortunate consequence of this is that for the actual date of Wonder Woman's 50th anniversary, October of 1991, there weren't any issues of War of the Gods or Wonder Woman out. If you look at DC Comics' publication slate for the month, I think Wonder Woman may have failed to appear in a single comic book on her anniversary. George Perez's last issue of the series was Wonder Woman number 62, released on December 10th, 1991, and the next Wonder Woman comic was the Wonder Woman Special number 1, published March 17th, 1992. Apparently with production delays, Wonder Woman would have missed a month or so, but DC opted to have her miss 3 months so that they could, I suppose, reintroduce Wonder Woman through this special, give people a jumping on point. It was a double-sized issue by the continuing artist on the book under Perez, Jill Thompson, this time inked by guest embellisher J.W. Geldof, who I'm not terribly familiar with and does not have very many credits. Karen Berger had quit editing Wonder Woman with George Perez and would fairly soon launch the Vertigo imprint. She was replaced by Dan Thorsland, and William Mester Loebs' first story arc would be Operation Cheetah. She could smell them first, of course. Beefy, frightened men, smelling of sweat and garlic and that yeasty black bread she'd always hated. She should never have come back here. It was almost as if he was waiting for her. Almost as if he'd laid out his shiny, expensive toys as a sort of trap. As if he needed her. Oh God, she had to get away. Fortunately, they were at a disadvantage here. She could hear them coming. To surprise her in these cold, still woods, they would have to be magic. They come at her in a dark, smelly wave, but silently. Even their boots make no crunch in the snow. Enchantment. Their clubs make no sound as they strike her. Screaming and spitting. But silent as the snow, she is dragged before him and his friend, the man with the horns. Trapped. Trapped without hope. In the aftermath of the War of the Gods event, the various gods of mythology had decided to call it quits in man's world and no longer have an active bearing in our modern times. Back in Boston, Wonder Woman was helping a kitten caught up in a tree. It was a snowy winter. Despite only wearing a sweater and a skirt, the cold didn't bother her. Diana was staying with her longtime friends and benefactors, Julia and Vanessa Capitellis. The group was visited by longtime supporting character Ed Delicato, who Julia referred to as Inspector Clouseau. This was a Boston police detective who was fairly uncouth. He often contrasted the more demure Diana, and he was bringing what he thought was good news. The cheetah had been captured in the country Pan-Balgravia, which used to be the People's Republic of Balgrave, before the communists had been pushed out. The new president was a former freedom fighter who'd fought against the communists for 20 years, but there were dark rumors about the new government. Anti-Semitism, torture, even devil worship. The longtime Wonder Woman villain the Cheetah had run afoul of this government and would be subjected to unthinkable deprivations. Vanessa figured that this was a bad lady that deserved it. Ed thought it was cause for celebration. Vanessa reminded everybody that she was a murderer and a thief and that she'd buttered her own bread. Meanwhile, Wonder Woman excused herself to go up to her room. When she was asked where she was going, she answered quite simply, to rescue the Cheetah, of course. They won't understand. Barbara Minerva is a woman, a sister to her. Whether she is a good sister or an evil sister is insignificant. And she knows the scope, if not the details, of what she is up against. A modern state with modern surveillance and modern terror. Her armor will not be enough, or her rope of twisted gold. She does have other resources, but they are dangerous to call upon. Very dangerous. While the semblance of a physical presence of the gods no longer existed in the earthly plane, they were still accessible in a metaphysical plane, particularly the lesser gods, one of whom Diana approached, Proteus. In between flaunting her title, fawning over the god, and even goading him, she was able to push Proteus into bestowing upon her a gift. Wonder Woman basically temporarily was given powers of illusion, which she used to create false identification for a new persona, Diane Prince. The hope was that Diana's mystical subterfuge would help to counteract the efforts of the state to detect her. But Diana still asked Vanessa Capitellas to contact her mother if she's not heard from in 2 weeks. Julia asked so that she could send help. Diana responded, "No, so she can find my bones." And with that, Inspector Ed and Delicato decided that he was going to be making the same trip as Diana, with or without her consent. Diana also recognized that she would need help beyond concealing her own presence. She would also need backup. Oddly, in the form of the mercenary Deathstroke the Terminator, and while it's not explained in the comic itself and related interviews, the connection to that character is made via Donna Troy and the Titans. But let's all be honest, it was all about Deathstroke hopefully helping to pick up Wonder Woman's sales and bringing in some new readers. More on that later on. Deathstroke is a total jerk to Diana and recognizes that she wouldn't approve of his methods, but he has his own motivations for going to Pan Bagravia, so he figures he might as well take Wonder Woman's dollar. At the airport, Diane keeps Slade Wilson waiting, and this is an instance where you can tell the woman's drawing the book because Slade Wilson looks freaking stylish. I can't think of a time when Slade was better dressed. He's in this nice, form-fitting black coat with a scarf, turtleneck, looks great. Meanwhile, Diane Prince shows up, and in this instance, Wonder Woman is channeling her friend and former publicist, Mindy Myers, basically giving out her persona, the bigger-than-life, darling type. And when she runs into Ed and Delicato on the same flight she's taking, he asks, and people wonder where the new Meryl Streeps are going to come from. It's nice that 25 years later, we're still asking that question. Slade Wilson wants nothing to do with Delicato, but Diana figures he would have some use. He's already on the plane, after all. Slade sets up a recon mission where he has Wonder Woman dress up in skin-tight white Kevlar. They would not only help to protect her, but also help to keep their cover in this snowy European land. And on first reading of the book, I didn't get it, but in rereading it, it's a nice nod to the mod Wonder Woman days. Hell, the whole espionage aspect and the return of the Diana Prince identity also pay tribute to that 60s run. The two characters penetrate the defenses of this castle. Wonder Woman's consistently critical of Slade Wilson's methods. He's way too kill-happy for her liking. And it all ends up being a trap anyway. But Diana does have Deathstroke leave with a captive, who he begins to interrogate rather roughly. Wonder Woman never signed off for torture, though, and points out that she happens to have a lasso of truth, so that sort of thing isn't necessary. Slade had forgotten about her mystic lasso, but also scoffs that not everybody has access to such a device, and he has to use the methods that he's used to in the real world. It's a conversation point that gets repeated ad nauseum over the course of the special. The prisoner explains that the Baron who runs the country is some sort of demonic worshiper, that he has all of these dummy castles throughout the country to drive people's attentions away from his true base of operations inside of a mountain, where he's involved with human sacrifice and other nasty business involving mysticism. Hence the army of silent soldiers stalking the snows at the beginning of the story. And it's at this secret mountain base where the mass graves can be found. The interrogation ends there, though, as the soldier sees, "Ah, he's coming for me, the joyful one, the man with horns." And then his head explodes. And it's weird because we've seen some nasty, bloody imagery related to the human sacrifice and the like, but when his head explodes, it's light green. Looks like something out of You Can't Do That on Television. So it's weird how the story will push some boundaries, but when it comes to the full-on Scanner's territory, it backs down some. So Diane Prince and Slade Wilson go to a restaurant that's known to be patronized by the Baron. He does happen to show up. They send him a bottle of the finest wine. The flibbertigibbet persona attracts the Baron, and he invites Diane up to his castle. However, on the way there, Slade Wilson forces him to stop the car. He suits up into his full Deathstroke Terminator gear and plans his own assault. Diana wants him to stick to the plan of going in incognito, and he bats her aside. She tries to lasso him to show him the truth of who he is, but he explains, "Sorry, Princess, I'm immune. I know exactly what I am." And then cracks her across the jaw, sending her flying into the snow. That's when the Furies take hold, and she leaps at Deathstroke, but then he blasts her with with his energy staff. For the first several pages of this fight, the Terminator is just completely humiliating Wonder Woman, and she at one point notes that he may well be faster than her. When she does begin to start showing signs of being able to overpower Slade, though, he begins being more tricky, using strategy against her. She realizes that in order to beat him, she will also have to employ strategy. Also, as the fight continues, she recognizes that Deathstroke's best blows can't really do anything to her. And over the long haul, it's Deathstroke who gets angry, gets sloppy, and eventually, after a bit of tussling about, Wonder Woman just decides enough of this and punches him in the gut, accidentally breaking a couple of ribs. She then tears off the evening gown that she had intended to wear as Diana Prince and uses it to bind Slade Wilson and throw him in the trunk of the car. She leaves Deathstroke in Edna Delicato's care and then goes for a direct confrontation at the mountain stronghold of the Baron. That doesn't turn out too well, as the army of demonic ex-communists show up, manage to subdue her, and then the Baron's ginger manservant, who actually looks sort of like a beefier version of Lex Luthor II, turns into a full-on red-skinned demon, vomits like molten lava at Wonder Woman, and knocks her unconscious. And at the end of the special, Edna Delicato realizes it's been 20 minutes, it's a little too long, he's going to go ahead and call on Slade, he pops the trunk. Not only is Slade long gone, but he's already left the scene, picked up some resistance fighters, and brought them back to where the car was parked. From there, we move on to the June 1992 cover dated Wonder Woman number 63, which makes sure to note that it's guest starring Deathstroke and has a corner box, reminding folks this is the thrilling conclusion to Wonder Woman special number 1. Unfortunately, there's been some shifts in the creative team for this concluding chapter. William Messner Loeb only provides the plot. It's Tom Pyre who provides the script, and Romeo Tangal, who had been inking the last few issues of Wonder Woman during the War of the Gods crossover, is back, and he definitely has an impact. It's not as heavy-handed as he was in the old days when he'd be inking George Perez on Teen Titans, but it definitely looks considerably different than the special had, at least to the trained eye. I think to the average reader may not notice the difference. So this one opens with the big monster who, given how they spoke about it, it's curious that he doesn't actually have horns. That seems like something you'd want to hew to, since it's such a key part of the script in terms of identifying this guy. That both when Cheetah was captured and when the soldier's head exploded, they refer to a horned being. But anyway, this guy's name is Drax, which, again, is too bad. I guess we're naming people after Marvel characters to make sure that they don't get reused beyond the story. Spoiler. Anyhow, this fellow carries Diana down to an underground dungeon, and he notes that one of her pupils is larger than the other one, indicating a concussion. And also, Drax determines this by inspecting the merchandise, in his own words, which will come up later on. Meanwhile, outside on the mountain, Deathstroke and the Freedom Fighters are working their way up to the stronghold. It's at this point that they leave Edna Delicato behind. Deathstroke keeps being a dick to Ed, trying to push him off, and when that doesn't work, Deathstroke straight up says, look, you're going to stay on this ledge right here, or I'm going to kill you and bury you here. So under those circumstances, Ed sort of sign of obliges, at least temporarily. Wonder Woman fairly swiftly breaks free of her chains and out of her cage, and it's revealed that the concussion was fake, that she was using the gift of illusion granted her by Proteus to fool old Drax. Once she's loose, she finds Cheetah in short order, except that she's no longer the Cheetah. It's a naked Barbara Minerva locked in a cage. And it's revealed that Drax is, I guess betrothed would be the word, to another feminine demonic presence. And he's looking for a host body strong enough to contain this more powerful entity than himself. The thought was that Cheetah would be that powerful body, but unfortunately, over the course of setting up the dimensional gates that would release this demonic force, the Cheetah reverted back to the Barbara Minerva form, who is fairly compromised and oddly, as drawn by Jill Thompson, looks rather old, and yet she's got a body that's very clean, very tight. So I think maybe the intention was to convey the tortures that had been visited upon Minerva, but really it just feels like one part or the other is unrealistic. Either her face is too old for her body, or her body is too young for her face. But anyhow, Barbara Minerva is trying to compel Wonder Woman to get her out and let's just get out of here. They're both in danger. Let them sacrifice some other poor woman. And at that phrasing, Wonder Woman stops and leaves Barbara Minerva in her cage, realizing that she's going to have to deal with this problem, that she cannot leave this situation untended because other innocent sisters will be felled by the blade of the Baron. Deathstroke finally penetrates the stronghold and begins stealthily, Metal Gear Solid style, murdering these centurions who are often about the same age as his recently deceased son. And even in recognizing that, still has no hesitation in ending their lives. He makes his way to where the Baron and Drax have created something that I suppose is supposed to be like a pentagram, but it's really more like the icon of the Sanctum Sanctorum. And the Baron casts a spell that begins levitating this goofy dagger. Wonder Woman and Drax begin the brawl. Deathstroke shows up with a grenade launcher, which he fires in a confined space. It explodes, and the only thing that's hurt is Drax's wardrobe. I don't think that's how grenades work. The ineffectiveness goodness of his grenade gives Deathstroke pause, and that allows the Baron time to send his levitating dagger into Deathstroke's shoulder. While Deathstroke's pinned to a wall, the dimensional portal opens, these tendrils begin to envelop Wonder Woman, but Drax's mistress was displeased because she cannot find the power in this form. Where is the power she needs? The mistress recedes, and we realize that this woman is not actually Diana at all. It's Barbara Minerva, made to appear as Wonder Woman through the illusion powers. Wonder Woman shows up and just begins beating down on Drax. Slade finally manages to remove the dagger, releasing himself from the wall, and a drop of his blood lands near Barbara Minerva. Deathstroke pursues the Baron, killing his way through all obstacles, but the Baron has actually been captured by Ed and Delicato, who explains that he has every intention of arresting the Baron, even though he is in a foreign land trying to take on the commander of this country. But he's arguing that Deathstroke's ways aren't the right ways, the moral ways to handle the situation. The Terminator literally says, "What crap," and then throws the dagger into the chest of the Baron, who vanishes into a red mist. The Baron is laughing the entire time, which prompts Ed and Delicato to say, "Nice strategy, Schwarzkopf." In the end, Barbara Minerva licks up Deathstroke's blood, becomes the cheetah again, and notes that she spent a lifetime seeking adventure, and that this will be the greatest adventure of all, as she leaps into the portal where the demon is housed. There's some debate about whether she's being self-sacrificing or just selfish, but it doesn't matter. It closes the portal, Drax's energies are lost, and he leaves behind merely a severely desiccated human corpse with white pink skin. It's graphic for a code-approved Wonder Woman comic. But then again, it was 1992. Who had time to read all those comic books anyway? They probably just saw Wonder Woman and rubber stamped it. The Amazon whispers an angry prayer for the cheetah's soul, interrupting it to scold her fallen sister. "You shouldn't have done that. I could have saved us. I could have saved us." Ed tells Diana we've got to get the hell out of here, and the pair bolt to their pan Balgravian hotel room. A mob soon forms outside the building, but they learn that these people are there to cheer for Wonder Woman for, again, liberating this country after it had fallen into the hands of a demon worshiper. The book ends with two pages of heavy text, clearly intended to bring readers up to speed who hadn't been reading the Perez run, basically reciting everything that had happened to the character since the crisis, and then also offering Karen Berger an opportunity to sing the praises of George Perez as she and he were outgoing. Perez made it clear that he was not going to be working for DC for the next several years, and I guess there was some desire to mend fences in this early point. At the very least, Karen Berger, who clearly had some solidarity with Perez, had the forum to thank him for the wonderful things he had done for the character. In particular, he notes that Wonder Woman was this character that for decades had been like a distant relative that everybody knew was there but didn't really care about, and that Perez had made Wonder Woman part of the immediate family of DC Comics, had brought her back to the fore, and that was a wonderful thing that he had done. And it was great that Berger was willing to acknowledge that even after the acrimonious departure of this creator from the DC fold.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Hi, I'm Tim from Cord Industries, the Blue Beetle blog. I'm here to tell you about an exciting new addition to the Silver and Gold family of podcasts. The show is Beatlemania, and it focuses on what is arguably one of the greatest superheroes in all of comics history, Blue Beetle. From the adventures of Dan Garrett the cop in the 1930s to Dan Garrett the archaeologist in the 1960s. From everyone's favorite Ted Kord to the more recent adventures of Jaime Reyes, we'll be covering the entire legacy of the Blue Beetle. And I won't be doing it alone. Joining me for this epic journey through the lives of the Blue Beetle will be Jay from the Silver and Gold Podcast. Together, we'll be discussing, reviewing, and celebrating the awesomeness of all of the Beatles. Beatlemania, coming soon to sngpod.com and cordindustries.blogspot.com.
My own personal experience, I bought this comic probably a year or so after it had come out, maybe not even that long. I found it in a discounted bin at a trophy shop that sold comics because everybody was selling comics in the early 90s. I did not buy this comic for Wonder Woman. I bought it for Deathstroke. I had become a fan while reading the reinvigorated New Titans series under Marv Wolfman, Tom Grummett, and the editorial stewardship of Jonathan Peterson. And even though I had missed buying Deathstroke when his series had launched, I had gone back about a year later to pick up his run. Here's one issue that I had. The special has a cover by Jill Thompson, inked by Jerry Ordway. So it's not a bad cover. But then in the first issue of Wonder Woman that came out, you have the initial offering from Brian Boland, as he would be the cover artist for about 4 years throughout the entirety of the William Messner Loeb's run. And I think that Boland's work is stunning. He's one of the greatest artists to ever work in comics. I think this is one of the greatest runs of covers that Wonder Woman ever had. I still think that Boland is one of, if not my absolute favorite Wonder Woman artists. And so it would have been really, really nice for him to do the cover of the special, which again, it's okay. I think that Deathstroke actually looks better on the cover than Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman is in a defensive position against an attacking Deathstroke. Unfortunate given that we're trying to promote Wonder Woman, not Deathstroke. But at least it does have a corner box image full figure that Bolin had created for the start of his run. At least he's acknowledged on this special. It's also a weird thing because around this time I started picking up the previous catalog, and I think they actually had solicitations that showed this first Bolin cover on issue 63, where it's noting Wonder Woman, she's back, and asking, did you miss me? The stunning return of comics' greatest heroine. And it just goes to show where the Wonder Woman character was in the fan consciousness at that point. Despite the fact that I had bought the War of the Gods debut issue, I was so unaware of what was happening with Wonder Woman in that time period. I didn't know she hadn't had a book for 3-4 months or so. I think Wonder Woman technically had newsstand distribution, but I hadn't seen the book on the newsstand in ages. But if it was out on the newsstand, issue 62 came out in December of 91, and issue 63 didn't come out until April 14th of 92. I tend to doubt that the Wonder Woman special got any newsstand distribution, so that's a 4-month period without any Wonder Woman comics. And as much as I'd like to think that Bolin had helped the sales on the book by coming on as a cover artist, again, beautiful, beautiful covers, I look at the sales numbers, and Wonder Woman at best held the line with the departure of Perez. Perez hadn't drawn the book since around issue 24, and it had already gone through two other artists that have never had the kind of a scene that Perez had. And Wonder Woman really wouldn't get another star artist until Mike Deodato Jr. 3 years from this point in time. So I think there would be some fear at losing George Perez, the primary creative steward on Wonder Woman for the last 5 or 6 years at that point in time. So I guess it is to the credit of at least Bolin, if not the rest of the creative team, that the sales were relatively equal to where they had been for the 2 years that Perez hadn't done the interiors on the book. At the very least, Bolin's covers had a parallel impact to what Perez's covers only point of sale offering had contributed to Wonder Woman's bottom line. I don't remember for sure when I bought Wonder Woman 63. It might have been after I actually became a Wonder Woman fan again and was collecting the book, because I remember buying the special and just liking it quite a bit. I did not care for how Deathstroke was characterized, and he was written as such a jerk for no good reason, and it didn't really fit with the perception I had of that character. But also, despite being a fan of anti-heroes and it being the height of the Chromium Age and my totally being sold on that era at that point in time, it still did not sit well with me for Wonder Woman to take the kind of beating that Deathstroke was giving her initially. Wonder Woman should have always handled Deathstroke. Deathstroke, I do at least have to respect his capabilities. I've seen what he's been able to do to the Titans. He's a solo villain whose abilities are mostly in the physical realm, who takes on entire super teams. Years later, he took on a quasi-Justice League that came after him and handled that fairly well. And even in the same time period as the series was coming out, he would take on several other iconic DC heroes and do surprisingly well against them. It was one of the reasons why I was really impressed with Deathstroke in this time period. But going one-on-one with Wonder Woman, a character who is partially defined by her own physical abilities, her strength, her speed, her fighting skills, it just didn't work for me that Deathstroke had the shot that he had with her, and especially the humiliation that he was dealing to her early on didn't sit well with me. And there was a misogynistic quality to it. Wonder Woman points out, go ahead and hit me again, Slade. I know how much you enjoy it. So while not only do I not enjoy seeing Wonder Woman put through that, I don't like that character anymore. I think that character has been rendered permanently toxic. I just have a hard time seeing him disrespecting Wonder Woman to that degree that openly for no other reason than Wonder Woman should, could, and ultimately did kick his ass. But beyond that, my main issue at that time period was the artwork. I was an Image kid. I was totally into all those flashy artists of that time period. Jill Thompson was not and never would be one of those type of artists. She definitely grew as an artist as her career progressed. I think she's very good at what she does. But even reading the art today, I have a greater tolerance for it because it reminds me of a lot of indie creators from that time period. And within a few years of being a Chromium Age kid, I was also an indie kid and just could appreciate a greater diversity of art styles. But the work is still very stiff and it just doesn't appeal to me very much. And it's not particularly good at conveying action. So it's still a sticking point for me. I actually welcomed the inks of Romeo Tangal in the second half of the story, or probably closer to the third portion of the story, since you've got a double issue and then a single issue. Given that Romeo Tangal is prone to overwhelming his pencilers, there was a little too much Thompson left over for me. But setting that aside, rereading it today, especially with the benefit of history and having spent a lot of time with the character, I really enjoyed those nods to the 60s strip. I do think it's a pretty good thriller. I do like they make a point of showing Wonder Woman in these somewhat darker and more violent situations to where the character herself is not diminished. She doesn't come across as having to be contorted in order to be involved in these scenarios. You have to remember this is still a warrior princess, and sometimes you got to get your hands bloody. I do like that she's always pushing back against the ruthlessness of Deathstroke while also seeing the necessity sometimes for his actions and his methods. I still don't believe that she would ever go to Deathstroke in a circumstance like that when she could go to somebody like Batman instead. But Batman wasn't selling comics the way that Deathstroke was that time period. So I get that Slade Wilson wasn't the only mercenary involved with the production of this book. They're doing what they can to reverse a long period of low sales. sales, or at the very least survive a major creative upheaval. And you do get a much more interesting contrast by putting Wonder Woman and Deathstroke together than you would have with somebody like Batman. I also think that if you were a new reader coming into this story, if you were more inclined to appreciate the Wonder Woman character than I was at that particular point in time, it wasn't a bad jumping on point. The story itself is fairly solid, and especially in issue 63, they give you a ton of backstory in those last two pages, so if you need to catch up, you can. But really, if you pick up the book with the special, you don't need a bunch of additional material from that. The story explains itself. It's contained within its two issues. But part of me does wish they'd taken a few more months off, gone ahead and debuted an entirely new creative team, maintained all of the elements of that creative team so that you could see the vision of where Wonder Woman was going to be going. From this issue, you had one more issue with the same creative team, and then you had a guest team on the issue after that, and then the art team completely changes. So it's weird that you're introducing Wonder Woman at a point in time where she's at a transition and she hasn't finished transitioning yet. So that's unfortunate. But given the problems I've had with some of the other jumping on points that we've covered on this podcast in recent episodes, this is actually one of the more accessible jumping on points for Wonder Woman. As a reader today, I wouldn't have a major problem with handing this story to somebody and going, hey, you could read this one, especially if they were fans of one of the characters involved. And one of the reasons why I'm covering this issue too is because I've had something of a run of negative episodes talking about stories that I did not enjoy, forcefully explaining why I didn't enjoy those stories. While I have a degree of ambivalence with this story, I think that generally I was happy with it. Unfortunately, I still have a few more negative stories to touch on, but I'm going to try to get in a few more positives in there as well. I don't want this to be a Wonder Woman comic books I hate year of Wonder Woman podcasting. And given my love for the way Mr. Loeb's run, I got to start somewhere. Not such a bad place to begin. If for no other reason, then I just love, love, love looking at this Wonder Woman cover by Brian Boland. And speaking of lovely Wonder Woman covers, there was a great one on the December 1991 cover dated Amazing Heroes magazine number 197. In this instance, I think Boland also painted the colors on the cover. It's just Wonder Woman smiling. It's freaking gorgeous. It's phenomenal. The cover features the once and future Wonder Woman, in which you're given a recap of the series to date, not just the Perez run, but the series in total, through a combination of an article by Richard Howell and a more focused article called The Queen of Comics by Charles S. Novinsky, who writes, "The War of the Gods crossover series will have some interesting ramifications for Princess Diana. Concerning the consequences of War of the Gods, the resolve of the series will be, as editor Dan Thorsland puts it, no more Zeus over for T-Stories. All of the pantheons are going to look around and see all of the trouble that they've caused and will decide to leave. It will put Diana in a position not unlike contemporary Christians. She will pray to gods, but she will have to wonder whether or not they're listening. The gods are very upset with mankind and Wonder Woman because she chose to live amongst them," Thorsland added. "Because of this, Wonder Woman will have to use guile, wit, and trickery when dealing with the gods. In one instance, Wonder Woman will be forced to trick a god into giving her the ability to disguise herself, allowing her to enter a foreign country undetected. To an extent, this will allow us to reintroduce the alter ego of Diana Prince." As of issue number 63, William Mester Loebs, writer of The Flash and Dr. Fate, will be taking over the series. Tom Pyre, former editor of Wonder Woman, had the job of picking Bill as the new writer of the series. Wonder Woman stories under Perez had been incredibly sweeping and of epic proportions with a vast population of characters. With Bill, there will be more down-to-earth, shorter stories focusing on fewer characters. Bill is very good about writing small stories about individual people in real settings, said Pyre. "What we will be doing," Thorsland added, "is presenting a number of one-issue stories in an attempt to make the book more accessible to new readers. Wonder Woman will be interacting more within the DC universe. We'll also see a lot of team-ups, and she will be playing a much bigger role, since she is this noble warrior that has to act when she sees an injustice being done," Loeb stated. "It will be interesting and challenging to write stories about a hero that isn't motivated by revenge, fear, or anger. Next to Superman, Wonder Woman is the most idealistic character we have, with Superman's ideas being a little more diffuse. Jill Thompson at the time was expected to remain with the series and noted that, when I first drew her, I didn't make her large enough. I drew her with human proportions. The note I received back with my sample pages was, she's a 6-foot woman, remember to draw her that way. As far as the physical changes were concerned, they just sort of evolved. I started thinking about her as I drew her, and it hit me that she was Greek. I thought back to some of the girls that I went to school with that were Greek, and I remember their features. They were different in the fact that their faces were more rounded, and that they had turned-up noses and fuller lips. For the most part, they had dark, curly hair, Italian hair, if you will. Basically, Wonder Woman is a 6-foot woman, not a 6-foot model. We need to see women drawn more realistically in comics. Wonder Woman is supposed to slug it out with guys every once in a while. She's not supposed to be wasp-waisted with twig arms and Jane Mansfield breasts. How can someone fitting that physical description walk up to a guy, punch him out, and then expect him to feel it? Now, here's a story that I don't remember ever actually getting produced. There were plans in the works for Wonder Woman to get involved in coaching a girls' softball team for Vanessa and her friends. Halfway through the game, everyone realized the Wonder Woman doesn't know the first thing about baseball. While everyone is dealing with this, they realize that the field is haunted by the ghosts of a dead black baseball player and the people who murdered him. It will be up to Wonder Woman to find a way to release the two spirits, and at the same time, hopefully, it will be able to touch upon the fact that there were some great ball players in the early Negro League. Wonder Woman will also eat a hot dog for the first time. Loeb has actually gained a vast knowledge of Greek culture from his work on Epicurus the Sage. I think there's a lot of generalization going on on, and it's easy to say the Wonder Woman is a vegetarian. Loeb sees it as just the opposite. After all, Wonder Woman was named after the goddess of the hunt. But, and this is a big but, Princess Diana is subjected to American culture. Some people in England won't eat our steaks because to them they taste like mucus. Someone that is used to eating raw meat out in the field will react in a humorous way to what we call meat in a hot dog. It was also noted that DC Comics at that point in time were sponsoring a Meals on Wheels program in Wonder Woman's name, and that Bill Loeb's had involved with a Detroit chapter of Meals on Wheels, and the intention was to tell some stories in which Wonder Woman herself would also be involved in Meals on Wheels in the comics. As far as research, Loeb referenced Perez's run quite a bit, but also stated that, "I sat down and read as many stories from the 40s as I could find, and I must admit that in reading the older stories in a big chunk like that, I did find myself quite charmed by them. Most of the women I spoke with remembered fondly the early stories. I found that we tend to think of Wonder Woman as being an unbroken line from those early stories up to the late 60s. After that, it seems as if what was lost was Wonder Woman's role as an active participant in the stories. In trying to make her the perfect woman and having her embody every principle of femininity, she became passive. And I think that that is the last thing she should be. I think what I like about Wonder Woman is the element of risk-taking in the sense of the real enjoyment she gets in the physical activity. We haven't seen much of that lately. Where she wouldn't be the first person to go into a bar and knock people out with her fists, she would be the first person to walk onto a ledge to rescue a baby bird. And maybe even more apropos, she would even be willing to get into a foreign country to save her worst enemy from the threat of torture and death because it's the right thing to do. One of the roles that Wonder Woman has played historically was that of a guide. So I thought it would be wonderful if she had a young woman around to give guidance to. I'm trying to bring Vanessa into the storyline as sort of a companion and adventurer rather than a costume sidekick. That's where the idea for Diana coaching Vanessa's softball team came from. Loeb's also intended to keep Ed and Delicato around, trying to build up a Catherine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy type relationship between the two characters. Messner Loeb's had plans to work more with Etta Candy and Steve Trevor, which I don't think panned out. I also don't remember him ever introducing Ginger Meyer, Minnie Meyer's sister, who was going to take over the Minnie Meyer advertising agency. Nor did we ever get to see Julia Capitellis as more of a swashbucking archaeologist that would be involved with Diana's adventures. Some other guest stars that I don't recall ever turning up were Hawkwoman and Black Canary, and a big one was they intended to bring in the Viking Commando. The idea was, why not, while she's trying to deal with American culture, throw some Norse mythology her way? And the article explains that the Viking Commando was a Norseman who was taken by the Valkyrie to Valhalla before his time. By the time the mistake was discovered and the red tape sorted out, the Valkyries returned him during World War II. Since the soldiers were fighting Huns and Vikings had a strong dislike for Huns, he joined the fray. Complete with fur vest, sandals, army fatigues, an M1 rifle, and his trusty axe called Iron Fang. At this point, it's anyone's guess as to how the Viking Commando will fit into the Wonder Woman scheme of things. And ultimately, he never did. But cool idea. They also talk a lot about how the Wonder Woman comic was supposed to have a Wonder Woman comic within it, the comic that people were reading that was produced under the auspices of the Minnie Meyer agency. It was going to be drawn by Trina Robbins, and it was going to talk about Paradise Island, which people know Themyscira from because of the comic. Talk about the purple healing ray, which Ed and Holocaust was supposed to be joking that, yeah, we'll whenever we get hurt, we'll just go get the purple ray zap, and we'll be fine. And Wonder Woman somebody explained to him that, yeah, it's great that you read the comics and all, but there isn't actually a purple ray, at least in that continuity. Mr. Loeb's also wanted to bring back Egg Foo, which unsurprisingly never happened, at least not in his time working on the books. And the piece ends on a somewhat disappointing note. The writer states that there are certain aspects that not even Loeb's cares to get involved with. There was this period in the DC universe when everyone had to have a family of books. Superman, Superboy, Wonder Woman, Wonder Mom, Wonder Tot, that sort of thing. We won't be seeing any of that type of material, and definitely no Invisible Plane. I wasn't a big fan of the Invisible Plane, and I don't think that it is one of the more memorable parts of Wonder Woman's mythos. I remember a story from the early days where Wonder Woman is being pursued by ICBMs, and she climbs onto the wing of her Invisible Plane, of course wearing her high heels, and traveling at something like 300 miles per hour, she deflects the missiles with her bracelets. Definitely no Invisible Plane. God, what issue does that happen in? I want to read that story.
You are about to see the first public exhibition of an entirely new form of entertainment. You are about to see.
Because you demanded it. It's Treasury Cast, a podcast devoted to the greatest comics format of all time, the Treasury Edition. DC, Marvel, Archie, IDW, and more, bigger than life. It's the Treasury Cast, part of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on fireandwaterpodcast.com.
wonderful words rang out from the 100 issues, Ally Bats, Dr. Ange, Between the Pages, Blue Girl, Brian Kim, Brody's Kitchen, Code Electro, Coffee and Comics Blog, Columbus Comics Corner, Comic Reflections, Comics in the Golden Age, DCU Movie Page, Dmitry Pimenov, Dr. G Nerdologist, Ed Moore Jr. at Indie Comics Fan, Marvel Bronze Age, Teal Productions, and Miskatonic, Inigo Montoya, Fan Drunk Podcast, Gord Tolton, Paul Hicks, Hulkling Aw Yeah, Jake and Tom Conquer Podcast, Jane at A Pinky Bunny, Janelle Dubois, Jeffrey Brown, John D. Knoll, Joseph Crawford, Justice's First Dawn, Keith G. Baker, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Mario at Luther Lang, Matches Baloney, Men, Nethead, Punch Like a Girl Podcast, Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, Radio Free Themyscira, Richard Field, Rob at Speculum Fight, Ryan Daly, Satin Tights Podcast, Sean Phillips, Shiny Gum Shoes, The Silver and Gold Podcast, Siskoid, Slangwood Resists, Style Icon, Tony Acero, Trekker Talk, Warlord Worlds Podcast, Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, We're All Monsters, Xenozoic Xenophiles, and Yuju. Trekker Talk announced that Diablo Frank asks who is Wonder Woman on the latest episode of Diana Prince Wonder Woman from Rolled Spine. And finally, Ange wrote, I've said it plenty of places before, but I'll say it again. I love the Wonder Woman character and I want to read her book, but for some reason it just seems hard to pull off. If you look at my collection, you can see that I have sampled plenty of creative teams on her book, but I have only stayed with a few. This Hindberg run is one that fell by the wayside. As you say, there is so much happening that makes little sense or seems put in to prove some sort of Diana knowledge. The story is like an omelet with too many ingredients and not enough egg. It just doesn't hold together. I dropped it after the third issue. Few things irk me more than delays. Once the days passed, I dropped the title, so I didn't know about issue 4 or the annual. Thanks for reviewing. Wonder Woman is the copyright of DC Comics Entertainment. This is a non-profit, fan-produced podcast. No infringement of any copyrights are intended. And where copyrighted material appears, it is believed protected under fair use. If you enjoy the show, please feel free to leave a comment on the Diana Prince is the New Wonder Woman blog, the Rolled Spine podcast blog. Write to me at emailofdiablu@yahoo.com, featuring 2 underscores. Or just hit me up on Twitter at CommanderBlanks or at Rolled Spine. Thank you for listening and have a wonderful week.